As Albertina has just kind of indicated from the title of my presentation, I'm going to talk to you today about the public procurement rules, and I'm going to present some empirical findings that will help me explore the social impact of those rules and their underlying ideology. So, as I said, the legal context for this presentation is the public procurement rules, and these rules set out how public bodies must run competition processes when they want to buy goods or services. And the key sources of that regulation are two directives from 2004, directives 17 and 18. Public procurement regulation, of course, has a much longer history than that. So these 2004 directives were amending and consolidating previous directives, dating back all the way to the 1960s. And of course, before then, we've got our bases in the treaties, particularly articles now 18, 34, 49, and 56. So Directive 17 deals with public utilities, but it's Directive 18 that I'm particularly interested in, has been the focus of my work, which is about public contracts. And Directive 18 has been implemented in the UK by the Public Contracts Regulations of 2006. And I've tried to summarise some of the key features of the procurement rules on the slide for those of you who are not familiar with them. So Regulation 4 makes clear that the contracting authority's fundamental obligations are equal treatment and transparency. And that implies a variety of compulsory procedural duties, and a contracting authority's discretion is also constrained in respect of how it conducts that procurement process. And in respect of the latter award criteria, the contracting authority can either choose between awarding the contract on the basis of lowest price or something called MEAT, which is the most economically advantageous tender. So this is a broader concept that obviously gives contracting authorities greater discretion. And so it's the criterion that tends to be used most frequently. And all of these rules might sound a little bit dry and a bit technical, but actually policy developments over the last 30 years or so, and now the financial crisis, means that these rules are increasingly important and controversial. And this is because we're living through a period in at least the UK where the market is king. So to use Michael Sandel's phrase on the slide, we're living through an era of market triumphalism, where almost all public services are potentially up for grabs by the private sector. Ooh, that was fancy. And the background, I wasn't expecting that, the background to the current position is really well trod, so I don't want to repeat it now. The point just for this paper is to say that neoliberal thinking has really proved very difficult to shake off. So it continues from Margaret Thatcher, albeit packaged slightly differently using the language of the consumer and service improvement under New Labour. And then comes along the global financial crisis, and some of us start thinking about whether or not this might prompt us to rethink the role of markets in public life. And this has definitely been reflected in the outpouring of academic and other writing in the wake of the crisis. And all of these books, I've only just covered a few of them in this slide, are really urging us to think more critically and more carefully about the balance between market and society and some of the potential bigger impacts of market dynamics in society. And of course, there's been a popular response to all of this. So this is, of course, a banner from the Occupy London protesters. And what I found really interesting about the discourse of their protest was that they weren't just objecting about specific banks or specific bailouts. There was an underlying current about of frustration about the type of society that we had become and the role that markets and economic principles were playing within it. But the political response really hasn't reflected much of that academic and popular debate. So rather than reining in market mechanisms, or at least reappraising their risks and benefits, what we've seen is the UK government at least placing market mechanisms at the heart of their response to the fiscal crisis. And we've got this policy of austerity at UK government level, and also, of course, among supranational organisations, the ECB, IMF, and that's meant reduced spending on public services. It's meant mandatory spending cuts, reduced services. It's meant that regulation very much seen as the enemy. Market works best when it's free, so we're going to deregulate. And within that context, the market's presented as both neutral and a natural solution, really the best mechanism that we can deliver more for less. That's the mantra at the minute. So we've seen some pretty radical developments with the private sector being invited to deliver all sorts of public services, especially in prisons, policing, and most recently, probation. And by way of a very brief detour, for those of you who don't know this book by Mark Blyth, I think it's an excellent read, and he's produced this YouTube video which summarises his ideas in 5 minutes, and I think it's a really good resource. I've put the link there on the slide. So, far from being this really dry set of technical rules, actually the public procurement legal framework has become the site of, a site of, ideological conflict. And that's really reflecting and crystallising some of these bigger social, political and economic struggles. So whereas some people will see the purpose of the procurement directives as confined to preventing discrimination, others will see these rules as rightfully pushing member states to open up their markets, and even kind of beyond that, to establish new markets in public services in order to achieve so-called best value for the taxpayer. And your view of the purpose of the directives will affect your view about the appropriate balance between the EU's competence in this field and the space for member state regulatory autonomy. So the problem with the second sort of analysis of these rules that would allow greater space for national regulatory autonomy in the pursuit of so-called horizontal policies, policies in the field of social policy and environmental protection, is that from the European Commission's perspective, these can smack of national disguised protectionism. And this is why the European Commission in particular has pushed a very narrow view of the scope within the rules for national authorities to take non-economic interests into account in their procurement decision making. And the textual basis for the Commission's view, narrow view, is that award criteria must be, quote, linked to the subject matter of the contract and must be economically advantageous from the point of view of the contracting authority. So this, the Commission says, precludes the use of social award criteria because these mostly don't affect the performance or the characteristics of the goods or services that are being purchased. These criteria can't be assigned a direct economic objective benefit. So to give you an example, office furniture produced at a factory that pays a living wage, so above a super, above a statutory minimum wage, is going to be just as serviceable as office furniture that's produced in a factory that just pays the minimum wage. So we can't assign that social benefit a direct economic objective value. And so the Commission's narrow and economic definition of value for money means that the focus is upon the specific individual contract from the perspective of the contracting authority, rather than from society's perspective more generally. And that makes it difficult to impose a contractual condition that relates to environmental or social protection that exceeds the statutory minimum. And it's in that context that Albert Sanchez Graals published his PhD thesis in 2011, which is a manifesto for the neoliberalisation of the public procurement rules. In essence, Graals argues that the public procurement rules are exclusively concerned with economic goals. He says they're strongly linked to free market ideals, free market economics. So their main purpose, their dominating norm, should be competition to achieve efficiency. And competition and public procurement law, he says, should be largely immune from other social policy concerns, which he says should be more appropriately dealt with in specific regulation, labour regulation, tax law, whatever. And Sue Arrowsmith then responded to Graal's thesis in the 2012 yearbook, and she argued that the EU doesn't have competence to mandate competition in its normative sense, as Graals was suggesting. And she suggested and argued that the purpose of the procurement rules is to promote the internal market only through non-discrimination and transparency obligations and the removal of access barriers. Competition, she says, has only got an instrumental role. It's a mechanism by which you remove discrimination and remove entry barriers to ensure transparency. It's not; it doesn't have this normative function that Graals was suggesting that it does. And then Arrowsmith's article has been followed in the yearbook again, in the last volume of the yearbook, by this article from Peter Kunzlik, which was exploring the ideology of the procurement rules. And he argued that the public procurement rules are a neoliberal construct. And he agreed with Arrowsmith that their further neoliberalisation, which is what Graals was arguing, was not justified legally. And so argued, as Arrowsmith did, that the instrumental use of the public procurement rules to implement horizontal policies ought to be possible. But he departed from Arrowsmith's analysis because he agreed with Graals and said that competition is an aim of the public procurement rules. But he presented a different definition of competition to Graals. So he says, competition refers to the structure of competition. It's concerned, quote, to protect the structure of the markets and equality of competitive opportunity between traders. So competition, he says, doesn't relate to the efficiency concept that Graals was suggesting. So, building upon this kind of emerging trend for public procurement scholarship in the yearbook, I am hoping to argue in a paper which is in progress for consideration in the next volume of the yearbook that notwithstanding the importance and, to my mind, validity of most of what Arrowsmith and Kunzlik are arguing, that actually there's a missing dimension in this debate. And that missing dimension is an empirical dimension. And I want to suggest that the empirical realities of competition don't always follow what we might expect from a doctrinal analysis or the macro socio-political context that we've just outlined. And on the basis of that empirical evidence, I want to argue that Kunzlik might have overstated the relationship between the public procurement rules and neoliberalism, and that it might be improved by reference to some sociology and sociological theory, and that Arrowsmith might be missing a trick or two in giving her analysis of the rules greater impact. And the empirical basis for these contentions flow from a case study that I conducted at HMP Birmingham, a prison in the West Midlands of England. And I spent 11 months here at a time when the prison was subject to competition for its management. in which the public sector was also allowed to construct and submit a bid. And the result of that process was that G4S was awarded the contract to manage the prison, and this is the first case of an operational public sector prison being privatised in this way in England and Wales, and there are very few international precedents. And what I did in the field was at both an establishment prison level and at NOMS level. NOMS is the National Offender Management Service. It's an agency of the Ministry of Justice, and it was responsible for delivering this competition. And I used mostly qualitative methods. There was quite a strong focus in my methodology on ethnographic participant observation. That was supplemented by focus groups, quite a lot of interviews, you can see the numbers on the slides there, and analysis of all the competition-related documentation. And that was supplemented by some quantitative data, and that came from two instruments that measure the quality of prisoner and staff life, which I collected as part of a research team from the Institute of Criminology, and that happened in 2010, 2011, 2012, and shortly 2013. And what I found then at NOMS level, through interviewing staff in the procurement directorate and by examining the contract documentation, was that bidders were being asked to comply with some fairly far-reaching social policy criteria, far-reaching at least when we compare them with the definition of what is permissible according to the European Commission. So at the pre-qualification stage, in the pre-qualification questionnaire, that's the PQQ, bidders had to provide some fairly extensive information that was employment related. And on the basis of that information, NOMS decided whether or not it would invite those tenderers to compete further, to participate in the dialogue sessions. So that means that the inclusion of these criteria at this stage was quite significant. And I've underlined some of the particular grounds that I think are fairly far-reaching. So I think especially commitment to CSR and ethical employment policy, quite far-reaching there. And at the best and final offer stage, known as BAFO, the response requirements there also included a considerable number of employment-related matters. Most notably, bidders were asked to comply with the public sector codes, and these set requirements that are above the statutory minima, particularly in requiring the new operator here, G4S, to provide public sector staff with broadly comparable pensions to their current pension provision. And that's pretty far reaching, I think, on any interpretation of what's permissible within the rules. And although these HR and staffing related matters were not the crucial determinants of the award decision, they were important within the evaluation weighting. So mobilisation, transition and transformation, MTT, which contained lots of employment related matters, counted for 35% of the available marks. TUPE, which is a piece of labour law legislation, accounted for 15% out of a total of 25% for CFL, which is commercial, financial and legal. And employment-related CSR, corporate social responsibility, attracted 29% of, albeit a very small 5% of available marks for CSR in total. Now, I'm not suggesting that everything was rosy and that NOMS could be seen here as being an ambassador for socially ambitious procurement processes. There were lots of deficiencies in this process from a social perspective. There were, for example, virtually no references made to the 30 or more documents at EU and UK level that set out how contracting authorities can engage in social issues and environmental issues in their procurement processes. And nor did there actually appear to be much knowledge about these documents at all, rather depressingly, among commissioners. And the contract, the final contract itself between NOMS and G4S, contains very few pro-social clauses. It confines itself mostly to a compliance model, which is based on NOMS avoiding liability for things like breaches of health and safety legislation or equality legislation. And there are certainly examples of other member states who are being much more ambitious in their policy documents, at least, about social matters in procurement processes, not least actually in Scotland, which seems to be pioneering these things. But what was really striking and probably what was most relevant about this for this paper was that there was no empirical evidence that the public procurement rules were an empirically significant cause of any reluctance to go further, to be more socially ambitious. Nor was there any recognition that what they were doing in the existing contract framework would in any way infringe or run counter to, be liable to challenge from the Commission. So there was no recognition that they were potentially infringing the procurement rules. Turning then to the experiences of competition, first at NOMS level and then at establishment prison level, the most empirically significant impact of the procurement rules was felt to be their, quote, paralysing complexity. Procurement was seen as such a specialist function because of how technical the rules are and also how high the stakes are if things go wrong. So liability in damages, political embarrassment, having to repeat the whole process again, that meant the whole... Yeah?
Sorry. Just in relation to liabilities and damages, because I've heard this risk, how many instances are there of damages being awarded for infringement of the procurement rule?
Not that many, when you look at the cases. But I suppose my point is, I haven't done the survey, so I wouldn't like to give precise numbers, but I think my point is politically, and the commissioners are acting under these political constraints. This was at a time when there was the cock-up over the Olympics. We've got numerous kind of contracting scandals. The stakes were seen to be really high. I think the Virgin were successful in respect of the West Coast. And so this was all bubbling round at the same time as this competition was going on. So perhaps there's a difference between reality and perception among the people who are making the decision. But maybe the mismatch doesn't matter so much as the reality that the kind of commissioning decision makers were experiencing. Does that answer it? Yeah. So the effect of procurement being seen as such a specialist function was really that it was hived off from the rest of the organisation. And that was probably why I found that there was a real lack of institutional planning, coordination, cultural reflection about what competition meant for NOMS as an organisation. And it was as if so much energy was required just to survive the process unscathed, that opportunities for improvement, for innovation, and obviously our pro-social opportunities or environmental protection opportunities were kind of squeezed out. And it also meant that it was procurement rather than the broader commissioning function that took the driving seat. And I think this quote is taken from an interview with quite a senior manager within NOMS, and I think it's really telling. The board don't seem to realise the idea and reality of competition are really very different. There's no consideration about level of resource, balancing of resource. We haven't thought about what it means for us as an institution. This word amateurish was used all the time in lots of my interviews to describe how the process was being delivered. And that context produced deficiencies in how the policy of competition was delivered. So the process was very long, 2 years. And there were multiple, sometimes unexplained, delays. And that meant that participation costs were high. The competition became predictably dominated by the big three who already deliver prison services, so G4S, Serco, Sodexo. And at times, commissioners seemed to lack the skills that were necessary to run the process, or sometimes they were kind of a step behind where they should have been. Sometimes that was because of political constraints, the government deciding halfway through to change quite important HR policies. And these sorts of policy shifts added to cost, added to delay and complexity. But the upshot of all of that, I think, is to paint a more complex and conditional picture than Kunzlik's neoliberal analysis perhaps suggests. I don't think what we're seeing, what I saw in this case study, was a picture of unbridled neoliberalism in action. Actually, we're seeing something that's more complex and needs more careful consideration, I think, than what's been suggested. But where I think Kunzlik's ideological analysis probably has greatest empirical bite is at the level of establishment staff. These are the public sector workers who are delivering the service, working in organisations that are subject to competition. Because I think it was at that level, in Birmingham at least, where neoliberalism most strongly manifested itself. Because the staff certainly would describe themselves as experiencing neoliberalism in action. They describe the process as commodifying their work, as displacing a public service ethos in favour of a profit motive, and in rendering their jobs and terms and conditions of employment as precarious. But while neoliberalism seems to capture the effects on staff in output or result terms, I don't think it fully captures the lived experience of competition processes, because most of the most empirically significant workforce impacts were mediated not by the public procurement rules, but by NOM's implementation and interpretation of those rules. In other words, what staff experienced as most damaging about competition and the process was not what eventually was decided, i.e. to award the contract to G4S, but actually the manner in which the process was conducted to reach that decision. So you see reflected in some of these quotes the pervasive lack of information, staff's lack of involvement in constructing the bid, here complaints about the length, and I apologise about the language, length and protractions in the process. Above all, staff were angry, frustrated, disillusioned about a lack of care, and the process was experienced as procedurally illegitimate. And all of that had operational impacts. So there were real problems around staff well-being. The prison was working under conditions which reduced its operational effectiveness over a period of a long, you know, 2-year period in a context of a service that was already under immense strain, with overcrowding, budget cuts, all those sorts of things. And just to illustrate the empirical significance of these impacts, this graph shows staff quality of life dimensions. These are the different dimensions I'm here. In 2011, and in 2012. So 2011 is just after the prison was privatised. That's the one in blue. I don't know, the blue and the green are probably not clear at the back. So the blue is this higher line. And 2012, so 1 year post-privatisation in green. And what you can see from that graph is a drop across virtually, dimensions. So staff quality of life has gone down significantly and very statistically significantly, particularly in the dimensions of the staff. So relationship with the organisation, commitment, involvement, motivation, safety, security and control. And these are some of the biggest drops that we have ever recorded at the Prisons Research Centre at the Institute. So really very powerful changes. And so what I want to suggest is that the neoliberal lens through which Kunzlik, in his article, suggests that we should think about the public procurement rules, doesn't quite capture these process impacts of competition. And these are partly, these arise partly as a consequence of the technical complexity of the procurement rules, and partly as a consequence of a contracting authority's broader mode of implementation of the rules. So it's here that I think drawing upon the work of sociologists, particularly Richard Sennett's Culture of the New Capitalism might be helpful. And I came to Sennett's work in the course of my attempt to try and make sense of the data that I collected at Birmingham. And he describes these three structural deficits that are caused by the new capitalist model outlined there on the slide. And I found strong evidence of all three in my empirical data from Birmingham. So, by way of a conclusion, what might this all mean and what do I think I'm arguing? Well, firstly, I think I'm adopting Arrowsmith's analysis, and I'm saying that there should be space for member states to use their procurement decision making to pursue horizontal policies. I'm quite convinced by her competence arguments, but I think I found in my empirical data a disjunct between what we might expect from a purely doctrinal analysis of the procurement rules and what really goes on in practice. And I found some evidence of unexpected, unrealised social boldness in social policy in the public procurement practice in the case study of Birmingham, and yet no perception among commissioners that they were doing anything bold and that might fly in the face of the public procurement rules. And I think I've also found in my case study a much messier, more difficult, a mutually burdensome procurement process on the ground than neoliberalism might suggest. And so to that extent, I'm arguing that Kunzlik's analysis, his neoliberal analysis of the procurement rules, doesn't entirely accurately represent the empirical reality. But I also found Kunzlik's neoliberal analysis to be in some senses too thin. It doesn't seem to me to fully capture the negative impacts and negative experiences of staff who are subject to competitive processes. And so for that reason, I'm suggesting that we might usefully draw upon sociological theory, particularly the work of Richard Sennett. And my final suggestion then is that as important as our doctrinal debates are, my empirical data suggests that the law perhaps is not in practice the most influential source of norms. So maybe for those of us who would like to influence the interpretation of the public procurement rules, our efforts might be better spent educating commissioners, working at the coalface of commissioning to understand how they make their decisions, than by proposing further legislative reform in an area that's seen so much reform in the past.